Hi there, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. This episode has been brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I'm your host, Katerina Stoykova, and my guest is writer Bobby Cohn. Hi, Bobby. Welcome to Accents.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your novel, Someplace Like Home, is out. Congratulations.
Thank you again. I really appreciate that.
And the jacket says that it's a novel about family, healing, and moving on. Tell us more about the story.
So this is a fictionalized version of my mother's life. Anyone who read my memoir, In the Shadow of the Valley, which came out in 2020, had a lot of questions about my parents because the memoir focused on my experience growing up. And this book really seeks to give my mother a voice and to bring her story to light. We talked after my memoir came out, and I realized that, you know, while of course I was initially focused on my story and my experience, one of the things I think is really hard for us to wrap our minds around, and certainly doesn't come naturally as a child, is that our parents are also individuals having their own experiences. I had never seen my mother as a primary character, so to speak. I had always seen her in relationship to myself and in relationship to my father, mostly. So when I began to hear more stories from her, it made me understand that she had a completely different perspective, not a different set of, well, she did have some different memories from me. We don't see our shared experience in her home radically differently. But she did have experiences that I didn't witness or couldn't have understood with my child perspective. So that really got me interested to understand her story. And as I dove into the writing, I knew that I wanted to develop greater compassion for her. I didn't realize how much room I still had to grow in that until I began the writing. And then it became a very transformative experience for me.
Transformative how?
So before I began writing this, I would have told you that, you know, I was caring and loving and forgiving of my parents for the different pain that I experienced as a child. I decided, though, when I began to write the book, I wanted to write the biggest section of it, which is book two within the novel, from that character Jenny's first person perspective. And Jenny is the character who represents my mom. The reason I wanted to do that is because I think when you're on the outside looking in, it's very easy to judge people's decisions and to see when they're self-sabotaging or when they're maybe unconsciously playing out dynamics that actually harm them or limit them, or just repeating, you know, maladaptive behaviors from the past. But when you're in the first person perspective, when you are that person, which I've been that person, it doesn't feel like that. You don't have that clarity. You're operating from a different lens. And I wanted this character, Jenny, to be someone that we could all have true empathy and care for. And I don't think you get that if you're just looking at someone and saying, yeah, that's obviously a bad choice. You know, why is this person doing stupid stuff?
You gotta make sense, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And as I wrote from this first person perspective to make us see and feel what Jenny saw and felt, it it really changed something inside me. It made me, I think, have true empathy rather than just sympathy. It made me feel like what I imagine my mother may have felt like at times as a teenager and a young woman, as a new mother, as a struggling mother. And it really shifted what I felt. All of the resentment that I was still holding on to went away, and it was replaced with a desire just to love her. Like, I wish I could go back and give her the love and support she needed. And it made me realize I can be okay, even though I didn't get all the things I needed. I see where that came from now. And I also thankfully have the tools to take care of myself psychologically and to go back and take care of and fix the things that were kind of broken or made dysfunctional in my childhood.
What has the impact of that impulse to save, to repair, to caretake been on you?
As a child, I thought that I could make my dad happy. Like, that was just the long and short of it, is I thought I could fix everything by being a good girl. You know, if I could clean the house or bring home good grades or make my dad laugh, I had this sense that, you know, most children get in those kinds of dysfunctional families, that I could somehow fix it. And the flip side of that, I believe, is that I also believed on some level that I was responsible for the entire situation. So, and I think it was, you know, my life took a pretty textbook direction for a while, at least on the surface, in that my relationships as a teenager and then young adult were very unhealthy and codependent. I learned about codependency in my 20s and began the unraveling of what that meant and how it controlled me and where it came from, you know, which is that desire to fix things and save people. It's very easy to go from a broken home to find a lot of other broken adults in the world that you can try to save and throw all of your love and attention and energy into, right? And it's always a bottomless pit. It's never successful. So that took a lot of time for me to undo and to realize that I could never save anyone except myself. And interestingly enough, I think one of the things that helped really solidify that growth for me was when my granny died. And my granny was the most important supporter in my childhood. She was the person that I felt the most unconditional love from. When she died in 2009, I found myself very angry and feeling very alone in a new way, because I knew that I didn't have anybody that I could go to if I was in a bind. Like, if I couldn't pay a bill, my granny would have helped me. If I had, you know, some sort of problem, I knew that she would have helped me. I went to her a handful of times as an adult, but it was just such a comfort to know that she was there. And so when she was gone, you know, I was also in a really bleak place in my life, and I was angry about how poorly everything was going. And I asked myself one day, like, who's going to fix this? And the answer was pretty loud and clear, like, nobody. If you don't, nobody's going to do it. Like, this is you. And that was one of those moments where I had to decide, like, yeah, I'm ready to grow up and not wait for the real adults to come in and fix things, because I didn't feel like a real adult yet. And of course, I couldn't wait for some knight in shining armor to come along and fix things. I realized it was on me. It was my responsibility. No matter who was responsible for the circumstances that got me where I was at that point where it was time for me to take ownership.
What does it take to break the cycle of dysfunction in a family?
I think for the majority of people who come from dysfunctional homes, whether that's including violence or addiction of some sort or abuse or all three, there's a lot more work that goes into it. And it starts with rebuilding yourself, because when you're a kid in a home like that, you're not developing a healthy sense of self. And now I am not a psychological expert by any means, so this is my understanding of the way humans work. I think it's a well-informed understanding, but
I'm sure it's well-informed understanding.
But I'm always open to being corrected if I'm getting something wrong by the experts. So, you know, when I look at myself as a kid, you know, I longed for love, right? I wanted, like all kids do, you need love and stability. And from there, there's a lot of different ways that a kid's life can go. But I think if you have those things, you have a solid foundation for normal psychological development. When you don't have those things, there's a real sense of unease, and you don't have really stable footing. And you're reaching, like I was reaching to my father for love, sometimes being given violence in return. I was reaching to my mother for love, and sometimes she just didn't have the emotional energy to give me the love that I wanted and needed. We didn't have financial stability, so there was always fear that we were going to lose our home or that we wouldn't have enough food to eat. There was the instability because my father was sometimes high or drunk, and so I didn't know what to expect from his behavior. So you always have to learn how to respond and adapt on the fly to these unpredictable moods. And I'm sure a lot of listeners know that experience really well. So I believe all of that undermines that child's sense of self, because they're not learning in a normal way who they are in relation to the world around them. They have to develop adaptive skills that are actually maladaptive. And I think that's the second time I've used that word today, so it's apparently my new favorite word. But it's not that the children themselves are doing something wrong or dysfunctional in a sense. It's all very predictable as to how kids have to learn to cope with these really unstable situations. That's a long-winded way to say that the first step is to rebuild yourself and to go back and do the parenting work that you didn't get from your parents when you were growing up.
To yourself, right?
Yeah.
Reparent yourself.
Yeah. And that's, you know, not my idea. It's a concept that's been around, I think, for a little while at least. But it's taken a while for it all to, like, come together in my mind and click as to, you know, what is the path forward? You know, it's important for us to acknowledge what's gone wrong, right? And to be able to share it and acknowledge it and get immediate help when we're in danger or struggling. And it's equally important, I think, to be able to forgive and move on. But we can't live whole lives as people who are running around with really a broken sense of self from childhood.
How closely did you work with your mom on this book?
So I initially, you know, we had conversations that led to me pitching the idea to my agent and the editors. And then I asked my mom to give me a list of the most monumental memories that she has, or what she would think of as being formative moments in her life. So she sent me this list, and what I did was call her on the phone and ask her to talk through the memories and just share feelings, details, you know, ideas, so I could get a sense of sort of the factual aspect of her memories, but then also what they meant to her. We really wanted the book to be nonfiction initially, but her memories aren't detailed enough for me to write it as a biography, for example. So what I ended up doing was basing this character, Jenny, on my mother, and that really gave me a lot more freedom to develop a story that's really vivid with a lot of details that are going to draw the reader into this world. At the same time, most of it is, you know, it's all based on places where my mother was and where she was spending her life, down to the street name and the way the houses were designed. There's a lot of factual information that serves as the structure of the story, and yet I wanted to fictionalize it enough to also protect her privacy so that she, you know, she gets to choose how much of the story she speaks about and claims as her own, because, you know, she did go through a lot. And I did, to answer your question more directly, she did start listening to the audiobook a couple of days ago, and she said that a lot of it was really spot on for her. And that was wonderful to hear, because, you know, you don't want to write this book and find out like it's the opposite of what she expected.
So she didn't read the book, but before it came out, but she started listening. Wow.
Right. Yeah, I shared a PDF draft with her via email at one point, but she's at a point where she prefers to listen to it. And, you know, I had to work a lot with my editor to get the structure right. It's ultimately broken up into three different parts, or three books within the novel, told from three different points of view. So there were really strategic purposes for each of those choices. And, you know, my mom isn't a writer, so thankfully she really entrusted me to do this and to render it into something hopefully beautiful and that we can be proud of.
What a privilege that is to have your daughter listen to you, to want to listen to you, to want to understand you, which is absolutely an act of love, an act of incredible bonding, I would say. And then trust your daughter enough, her goodwill, her talent, her understanding, to tell your story. I think that's incredible, Bobby.
Well, thank you. I hadn't thought of it like that so much. You know, I mentioned earlier it was very transformative for me to write this. And I also feel like there's so many women who've gone through experiences like she has, and most of them don't get to tell their stories. We don't understand what it's like to be inside those homes if we don't come from those homes. And none of us want to be in them. So yeah, I really saw it as an important act of service on my part.
Would you read a little bit from the book for us?
Yeah, I picked out a passage that is maybe a little upsetting for some listeners.
So, a content warning.
Yes. But I picked this passage because I, you know, like we've been talking about, these experiences are often, we learn about abuse from just such a removed point of view so much of the time. And, you know, maybe we feel a little sympathy toward people who are being abused, but I also think it's really easy to be judgmental toward people that we see in abusive situations, especially if we perceive that they choose it over and over. And there's a lot there that's a very complex topic that I hope to spend more time helping unpack. You know, one of the things that I tried to do was write some of those abusive scenes from the first person point of view in a way that would make us care about the character. And this is one of those. We're starting as there's been a verbal argument between Jenny and her husband, Rob, and the situation begins to escalate. I started crying, thinking he would let it go once he saw how upset I was. But this time, I don't think he saw. He came closer until he backed me up against our bedroom door. He started saying all kinds of things that didn't make sense. Most of the time when he was mad, he would start yelling. For some reason this time, he was keeping his voice low, but it was like he was about to explode. At least the kids couldn't hear him. "I'll teach you to get into my stuff." He turned away and walked to the dresser where his leather belt was lying. I couldn't believe he was going to hit me with it, but something told me to get out of there. I opened the door, walked through the living room, and out the front door. "Jenny?" I had made it to the yard when he yelled my name. He started coming out the front door. The belt was in his right hand. "What are you doing, Rob?" I was crying even more. "Why are you acting like this? This is crazy." As soon as I said crazy, I knew I'd made another mistake. He started walking toward me, and I turned to run. "Get your ass back here," he told me, but I kept going. He got a handful of my hair right when I made it to the back of my car. I wasn't trying to get in the car. I was just trying to get away. Where was I going? I don't know. I wasn't thinking straight. I guess Rob had dropped the belt because he started hitting me over and over with his fist. He pulled my head toward the gravel so he could get the back of it, never my face, and hit me in the back, too. For some reason, he kept dragging me toward Ella and George's house, even though they would have said something to make him stop if they had seen it. I guess he knew we wouldn't make it all the way to their door. I probably would have been dead by the time we had made it that far. The kids must have heard the commotion because Rob stopped when we reached the first fence post. He kept my face pointed toward the gravel but turned around to yell at them, "Eat your fucking pancakes." After that, shooting stars exploded behind my eyes and I dropped to the road where the gravel bit into my bare arms and legs and the side of my face. He left me there and I noticed he went to the barn instead of the house. That meant he wasn't going to say something else to the kids right away. But did he have a gun in the barn? I thought all his guns were in the house. I hoped they were. And then I was overcome with a wave of exhaustion. I think I laid my head down on the gravel just for a second. Did I fall asleep? I don't know for sure. I can't remember walking back to the house. Later that night, I took off my clothes to shower and stood in front of the mirror. The red marks from the road probably wouldn't turn to bruises. The bruises that were starting all over my back wouldn't be seen by anybody but Rob. A dull headache had settled in, and I knew it was going to last for days, maybe longer. When he came inside later, Rob looked at me and asked, "You okay?" I nodded, and he nodded back with a look that seemed friendly. What he didn't say was, "I'm sorry. Did I hurt you? Is everything going to be all right?" But I thought he meant those things, even if he didn't say them. I thought he felt bad about what happened, even if he didn't know how to apologize. We would smile later when he remembered what he had spent that missing $20 on, and I would push it all away that night when he climbed into bed next to me.
What was it more difficult to write, your memoir or this book? Meaning, is it harder to talk about your own pain or the pain of someone you love?
I think in a lot of ways it was harder to write this book because, you know, my pain I was already very familiar with. It was still a really intense experience to write my memoir and to go through the different revision processes and even narrating it. But with this, you know, I discovered so much as I was writing this story, discovering just, this might be really hard to, for me to convey as clearly as I would love to, but as I was writing, I felt like, you know, even if it's not a perfect representation of what my mother felt and how she thought, I think it is a close approximation of what a lot of people think and feel in those situations. And that is, that set of thoughts and feelings is really dark and lonely. And there's a lot of disassociation, of course, that a lot of people experience when going through abuse. So I had to put myself into that persona over and over to write this. And that was really difficult at times. It was very uncomfortable. And I felt a lot of love and compassion for my mom. And even to some extent, you know, for my dad, as I was writing it, it was just a really intense experience.
What would you say to someone who says, why do that to yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? Maybe that's something that a lot of art pushes us into, is the shadowy aspects of the human experience. You know, a big part of it for me was that I don't want to be controlled by the past, and I don't want to feel like my identity is controlled or negatively defined by the past. I used to think that if I worked on myself enough that I would somehow be fully free from the past. And now I don't think that's ever possible. I think that, you know, for better or for worse, I was shaped by my early experiences. I'm never going to be someone other than the person I am with the history that I have. You know, I'm always going to have a childhood that was defined by a lot of painful circumstances, but I feel like I can choose to empower myself now so that those painful circumstances become tools for me to use, and most importantly, to help make other people's lives better. You know, I think that's a really big part of my calling, I guess, for lack of a better word. I feel inspired to write so that I can help others. And that's my biggest hope, is that it does that for other people.
You know, I say that about my books, and I hear a lot of other writers say that about their books. And the only other profession that I've heard people consistently say that are the doctors. Well, there is a testament to the healing power of literature.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just such a magical medium for us to work in. And, you know, I do think there's something really powerful and beautiful about the human language and the idea that we can evoke feelings and memories and even change our own minds just through the words that we say or that we read. Like, it's really incredible.
Can you talk about grit, not only to survive, but to thrive?
Yeah, sure. Grit. So I've often called myself a stubborn optimist because personally for myself, I felt as a, like probably at during my teen years is when I started feeling like I was being pulled in two different directions. You know, on one hand, there was beauty in the world, and thankfully I'd also read a lot of books, and so I was aware of all these different possible versions of what a life could look like and how people behaved and what kind of experiences we can have. And then my life trajectory was pulling me into repeating the cycles of abuse, addiction, and to stay mired and stuck in poverty. And I really felt like I was, as I said, being pulled in two separate directions. And there were times as a young adult when I just felt like I, you know, there was no sense in continuing to hold out hope, you know, even if I maybe didn't want to say like, oh, I'm ready to give up completely. It was like, I was ready to resign myself to a life without happiness and without joy. And there was always something inside of me that said, no, I'm not going to accept that because I have seen good things in the world. I have seen beauty. And for me, beauty is probably one of the sort of easiest placeholders for to refer to goodness as a whole, you know, beauty in all forms. So I've seen all this beauty. I've witnessed it and at times experienced it and felt it. And so that made me say, you know, I'm going to hold out for more of that. And I always thought of that as my stubbornness. I am an innately pretty stubborn person, although I try to be also flexible. Yeah, grit, you know, and resilience, I think are really important. And a little bit of hardship is, I think, a normal part of the human experience and probably a good part of the human experience to teach us some resilience and to show us our strength. There were times when I felt like, well, I'm not strong enough for this. And then the voice in my mind was saying, well, you better figure out how to get strong. You know, like, it doesn't matter if you're strong enough. You have to figure it out. I felt that way about parenting at times. Like, God, I don't have the strength or the energy or the courage or the whatever it took, the patience. And it was like, and? Yeah, that's great. You don't have it. Go make it. I do want to say, though, as much as I think it's important for us all to develop those skills, I think it's important for us to try to build a world where we have fewer children who have to rebuild themselves from the ground up. I don't think that's a reasonable expectation, you know, for kids to be abused and neglected and not supported, and then to just think like, well, when they're adults, they can figure it out.
Yeah, like a few years of therapy and they're good as new.
Right. It's enormously hard to find the resources, even if you have the money. Like the emotional and psychological damage done by those circumstances really impacts your ability to, you know, make those decisions for yourself.
And or to even want to help yourself.
Yeah, it's a really, you know, it's a dynamic that like self-perpetuates and keeps people stuck. We shouldn't wait for kids to grow up and find the answers for themselves. Like, I'm grateful that I've been able to do that to the extent I have. I feel enormously blessed. But, you know, I think preventing kids from ending up in those kinds of situations is 1,000 times more impactful and effective than us trying to pick up our broken pieces.
Speak about your connection to the land. Mm. And by land, I mean not only Appalachia, but the earth.
Well, so a lot of that beauty that inspired my stubborn hopefulness as a kid and young adult, you know, it came from the landscape that I was so fortunate to grow up in. And I've written about this in a couple of different places. You know, I feel so fortunate that when I was, you know, going outside of my house to try to get away from my father, where I got to run to was, you know, a beautiful stream where I could play in the water. I got to run up into the forests of in the hills of the Daniel Boone National Forest. There were wildflowers all around me and blackberries and, you know, deer and wild turkeys and, you know, just all of this life that was just quietly persisting. And it helped me see that, you know, of course, without realizing it, it helped me see that there was so much goodness that was going untouched and unharmed. And I felt a real benevolence.
Safe place.
Yes, absolutely. Like the outdoors was my safe place. And it might seem, I don't know, it feels a little odd to me now to say that I felt this benevolence from the natural world, but I really did. As a kid, I felt like it was somehow protecting me and comforting and nurturing me, especially the hills. I feel like I still associate the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains as being these, like a warm and loving embrace from the land. So, yeah, to me, like seeing life constantly thriving in one form or another was a really powerful and unspoken lesson.
Tell us about your relationship with Berea College.
I owe so much to Berea College. I didn't really have a vision of myself going to college. It was my art teacher in high school, Steve Thompson, who had, unbeknownst to me, he had just graduated from Berea College when I met him as his high school student in art class. And he encouraged me to apply. There's a great story there. I'm forever indebted to him for his direction. And when I got to the college, so, you know, that's its own. There's so many stories. So
maybe it's a book there.
Yeah, and some of it's in my memoir. Some of it I've written about in the college magazine. So maybe I'll have to dive back into a longer piece about it at some point. But when I got to the college, which of course was tuition free, it was a nurturing environment for me. I liked how small it was. I also felt like it was really freeing to be away from my hometown and to get to reimagine who I was, and to not have like all the weight of my past experiences and really some of the painful aspects of high school. Like, I got to leave that behind, which was very freeing. I also took a philosophy class right off the bat. And, you know, I thought I'd be an English major and ended up taking a philosophy class and then another. And then I became a philosophy major. And this desire that I had to make sense of the world, which also came from, you know, I think that childhood dysfunctional home where nothing made sense, right? At a young age, I became someone who wanted to kind of argue to get people to make things make sense. And I probably just came across as being difficult, but I was really looking for something that could hold true and not leave me or not abandon me and not fail me. And when I got to all these philosophy classes, instead of me seeming like a pain in the ass to everybody, instead it was celebrated that I could pick apart you know, something that we'd read by some philosopher, or I could compare one philosopher's work to another philosopher's work and find where they contradict one another, for example. So that was just such an affirming experience, to find that this thing that felt like a flaw could be used in a good way and in a productive way. It helped me develop really solid, I think really solid critical thinking skills. And a lot of my professors also pushed my writing skills. And, you know, I ended up getting a bachelor's degree without debt, which was, I didn't understand the value of that at the time, but it really was the first crucial step in helping me overcome generational poverty.
So I happen to know that in lieu of paying tuition, the students of Berea College have to work. What did you do?
Well, my very first job was as a janitor, which, you know, certainly nothing glamorous about that, but it taught me a lot of respect for people who clean. It gave me a lot of appreciation for that. And it also helped me see, you know, I think classism in our society is a very important topic and something for us to collectively work on. But yeah, it gave me a little bit of insight into classism, even in a great institution like Berea College. After that, let's see, I worked at the bookstore during one of our short terms, which was just for the month of January. And then I ended up being a TA for one philosophy professor, and then I was a research assistant for a philosophy professor. Yeah, and then I think I wrapped up my tenure there as a TA for yet another philosophy professor. So, which all of those were just amazing experiences because I got to be in the classes and I got to read more philosophy and just continue learning while also helping other students and helping the professors.
I don't know about you, but I and a lot of other writers experience writing pauses between projects. I mean, I do. So the question is, do you? And if you do, how do you deal with it? Tell me.
Yeah, I have a full-time job. So, you know, I have to be very disciplined when I'm writing. I like having deadlines. So for these last two books, I was fortunate that they were under contract pretty soon after my memoir came out, or maybe when it was getting ready to come out. Anyway, so I had my next deadlines lined up pretty quickly. So yeah, I'm a very deadline-oriented kind of person. Right now, I'm waiting to hear back on my next book proposal, so that I can really dive into the writing on that and see if it's going to move forward as a project. But what I've decided to do, because I am about ready to get into writing again, I've given myself a break since Someplace Like Home came out. I've written a few essays that have gone into like Lit Hub and Time Magazine and that sort of thing. So those were also pretty intensive short deadline writing projects. But I think it's important to give yourself a break. I do. I think that for me, it allows my mind to rest and kind of gather and, let my thoughts meander around on concepts and ideas and feelings, so that when I'm ready to write again, then I can, I've had this time for things to coalesce in my mind. And then, of course, as you write, things coalesce even further. But I do think it's important for me not to take too long of a break, or I would feel like I would lose momentum and you know, I've had people tell me like they haven't touched a manuscript in years, and that would stress me out a lot, because I think it's really easy to then just ignore the manuscript, or for it to just become like a dream that gets further and further away. So I intend to keep myself on some sort of deadline, even if it's self-imposed rather than externally.
So would you share with the listeners of Accents about your book proposal, or would you rather not yet?
I am happy to share it. It relates to some of the things we've talked about today and that I'm really excited about. So when my memoir came out, you know, a lot of people asked me, like, how did you escape, basically? How did you create this new life that's so different from the way you grew up? And, you know, at the time, what I had to point to was really, it just didn't feel, like a good enough answer to me, because it was like, oh, there's my stubborn hopefulness, right? And there's all this beauty that I was inspired by. Well, not everybody can be surrounded by the Appalachian Mountains or any kind of beauty. You know, that's not a roadmap. That's not a blueprint for how to take care of oneself after experiencing trauma. So one of the things that I want to really focus on in this next book, which I expect will be another memoir, will be, you know, what are the practical things that I did to help rebuild that internal self, like I mentioned earlier, as being that first step. I sat down and thought through it and shared the information that I came up with some people who have more in-depth psychological training, to make sure that it was in line with the way, you know, actual professionals view human development. And so I want to write about that and share that with the world, so that more people see, or like have those tools as ideas that they can use. And I also want to connect it to stories again, because I think that stories speak to us. Like, I wouldn't go pick up a self-help book. 9 times out of 10, I would rather read fiction or memoir. You know, I don't, self-help can just feel so dry, not to knock it. It's a very important genre. But I feel like stories can reach people in a way that sometimes, at least it's going to be a different audience, potentially.
Some people, one doesn't exclude the other.
Right. But some people are not going to pick up a self-help book who did read my memoir. You know what I mean?
I see.
And when they read it, they were surprised to find they related to me so much, and they were inspired, and they wanted to make changes, and some of them did. And I want to continue building on that by sharing more of my journey. And also another goal of this book is going to be to really look at, I'm trying to think of the most succinct way to say this, but to look at really what goes on in the human mind when we're experiencing different kinds of trauma and different kinds of, say, abuse or suffering even, right? Because not everything is abuse. Some people don't experience abuse, but they still have painful experiences that shape them and that they have to work to get past. So an example of that is, for me, experiencing the physical and emotional violence from my father, and then going to church and being the particular messages that I grew up around in church reinforced this idea that I was responsible for everything that was happening to me, and that it was actually, you know, it was my fault because I was a sinner and I was supposed to feel bad. So I think that compounded the sense of shame and guilt and self-loathing that I developed, because it wasn't just, you know, it's not just abuse that stays put in its own little, in the four walls of our home.
It's systematic.
Yeah. And there's all these, there's these relationships between, the different systems that we live in and the different communities and groups that we're part of and interact with. Basically I just want to look at how do different experiences inform each other and complicate things for us, and then how do we unravel it and empower ourselves.
What is the most important thing you teach your students? If you want them to remember one thing from your class or workshop, what is it?
Wow, that's a great question. So, I'm fascinated by how the human mind works with symbols. And I think that, that's related to why metaphor is such a powerful tool for us to use in creative writing. I have a writing exercise that I came up with for one of my classes, and I'll share it. I'm so excited about it. Every time I think about it, it might sound silly, but I asked my students to think about what they had for breakfast that morning and to write how that breakfast was the perfect representation or the perfect metaphor for their lives.
Wow, guess what I'm going to be writing tonight? I'm going to be answering that question.
Yeah, it comes to my mind all the time. And sometimes it amuses me, and sometimes it's like a sobering thought, but I just always find it intriguing and informative in my own life. So that example, to me, it reinforces the idea that, everything is interconnected. And when we're doing creative writing, we're trying to bring aspects of the human experience to the forefront in some way, celebrating them or shining a light on the importance or making us feel something that we don't feel constantly, even if it's like horror writing, right? You read horror writing because you want to have a certain experience of fear that you don't have regularly.
I cannot.
It's not my genre.
Some people can, and I cannot imagine scaring myself.
Same. I mean, I don't know, maybe when I end up with a lot of free time, I'll delve into it and see what I can do, but I don't watch scary movies because I've got enough to draw from in my own past. But so it's that the use of metaphor and symbols, and I think if we look for those in our own lives and see how our own minds work with symbols and metaphors, it's just such a beautiful tool to use in creative writing, and I think it just comes so naturally to humans to work like that.
Thinking about that writing prompt that mm-hmm. you created, which I love, and just now I'm thinking, okay, I could think of what I used to eat when I was 7 years old and how that was a representation of my life at the time, and then let's say in my 30s, and then let's say now, what did I eat this morning and how that really represents my life. That is wonderful, and I'm definitely going to try that, and I hope our listeners will also attempt to figure out their own answer. And I thank you, Bobby, for being with me and giving me so much of yourself.
Thank you, Katarina. I really am grateful to be here.